Well, our 1 Samuel teaching series is called From Where Does Our Help Come From? And I was just really encouraged to hear from Lydia and her story before about God's work in their lives and just the healing that was brought. And even as I was just thinking about that title, From Where Does Our Help Come From? We know that in many different ways, that help comes from God. And this is a big question as we follow the rise and fall of King Saul and then King David. We know from previous weeks that Saul was powerful, but he failed to be obedient to God. And we heard last week that David was chosen as the next king because he had the right heart, a heart that would follow God. And with the narrator, we might be wondering how God's promise to Abraham to bless all people through his descendants will eventuate. People are in the promised land, but there's no leader to protect and guide, no worthy leader. And we're wondering, will it be David? Is David the one who will lead? Well, David seems to be showing promise and demonstrating that he has the right heart. He shows compassion and spares Saul's life. He demonstrates that he's also a mighty warrior, able to protect people and even bring down giants. The people are now singing songs that David has slain 10,000s compared to Saul's 1,000. And Saul is jealous of David's popularity. As we pick up the narrative in chapter 25, David, although anointed as the next king, is still on the run from Saul. But there's a sense of hope for what is to come. So if you have a Bible with you, then I recommend opening it up. It's a little bit of a long chapter, but it just helps to anchor you as we follow this chapter and story. So chapter 25 of 1 Samuel. As every writer knows, a good plot starts with an exposition, like introducing the characters and establishing the setting for the story to follow. In the first 8 verses, we're introduced to Nabal and Abigail and David. David, his Hebrew name means affectionate or beloved. Nabal means foolish. And we're given an extra description. He was surly and mean, hard and evil. And we're kind of given a clue here of what might happen. Abigail is a combination of father and joy, and we're also given the description of discerning and beautiful. Calebites, possible relatives of David, and the Calebites have founded Bethlehem. So there could be a relational link between Nabal and David. And there's shearing at Carmel. So the place of Saul's, if you remember back, it was the place of Saul's monument that he put up. Perhaps Saul won Nabal's support with some of the sheep plundered from Amalek. Not sure. But I wonder at the repeat of a delegation to him. Now David hears that Nabal's sheep are being sheared and sends a delegation to Nabal and to ask for a share in the produce. Verse 7. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, the whole time they were there, nothing of theirs was missing. Now, David's character is on show here. He was hiding out from King Saul in the desert of Maon, which is not where Nabal's land extended to, but Nabal's sheep were grazing there. David could have so easily stolen the sheep by force. I'm sure his motley band would have been quite happy to steal them and eat them, perhaps. But as opposed to Saul, David didn't profit from his force, his might, but showed love to his neighbour, Nabal, by looking after his sheep. Well, so far, so good. We've learned that David has guarded sheep rather than stealing them, and then has politely asked for a share in the fruit of the harvest. We're thinking now, David is the right person to be king. He's strong and he's the heart of a shepherd. However, David's kindness doesn't get acknowledged. Nabal, true to his name, responds by insulting David. He says, "Who is this David? David and his men, they're nobodies. They're just a bunch of runaway servants. So no thank you for minding my sheep. No acknowledgement of kindness. Instead, a string of insults." So imagine for a minute that you were wandering the streets of Kew after church and noticed a cute stray dog, which had in front of your eyes just been narrowly missed by a couple of cars shooting through the back streets, going too fast. And after spending maybe about 30 minutes finally catching it, you read the phone number off the dog tag and call the owner. When you explain that you have the dog, the owner verbally criticizes you for touching their dog and threatens to call the police. Well, I'm sure this would make you angry. It would make me angry. And you might think, I didn't have to save the dog. I could have left it. I've wasted my time helping this owner, and all they want to do is criticize me. Well, perhaps in the same way, Nabal's foolish response also comes back to David, causing him to get angry. David immediately gets red hot angry at Nabal's harsh response, like a spark to dry fuel on a hot windy day. Verse 12, David said to his men, "Each of you strap on your sword." So they did, and David strapped on his as well. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. I'm reminded by Nabal's foolishness in the words of Proverbs 15:1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Nabal's foolish and harsh words stir up anger in David, and we get an insight into David's mind later on when he says in verse 21, David said, "It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness, so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good." So you can hear that sense of injustice and the unfairness in David. He was right to be angry, I think, at the insult and the lack of gratitude from Nabal. But David was being consumed by his anger, and it was rushing him headlong into foolish action, action that would stain his reputation and work against God's plans for him and for the people as future king. I looked on our government's Health Direct website, and it was interesting to read about what causes people to get angry. It said, anger may be triggered by situations that we think are unfair, or someone has wronged us, someone has humiliated us, someone has put our social status at risk. And I thought to myself when I read it, David had all those things going on. I can imagine David clenching his muscles and anger rising to his head. Will Rogers, a comedian, famously says about anger, "People who fly into a rage always make a bad landing," which is a kind of a humorous way of describing the kind of dynamic that often happens when people fly off the handle. And this is where things were headed. David was heading for foolishness. David is caught up in anger, and we're wondering, will he descend into the kind of leadership like Saul and Nabal? Will David turn out to have power and with a heart of passion, but without wisdom? Well, wisdom had departed David. However, wisdom was on its way riding on a donkey sent by God in the form of Abigail. Through wise words and action, Abigail saves David from sinning and keeps God's plan on track. When Abigail hears the reply of Nabal and David's hot-headed response, David acts with, Abigail acts with exceptional wisdom. She didn't dismiss her servant's report, but she took their report seriously. She acted quickly. And notice that wisdom doesn't necessarily mean slow. An action isn't automatically wise or foolish based on the speed of the decision. Abigail organized her servants to gather food for a large number of people. And I like how there's a detailed description of just how much food there was. There was like bread, wine, sheep, grains, and loads of sweet cakes. I think if you want to placate a big army, then the fastest way to do it, I think, is with the stomach. And it serves to repay David for his protection of the sheep. She then loaded it all on donkeys and intercepted David and his men on the road as they were marching in. Now, when Abigail meets David, he's still angry and even says this line. He says, "May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." So he is just so angry. So not a good state of mind. But Abigail is brilliant. Look with me at verse 23. She bows as fitting a future king. She calls David my lord. And by doing this, she gives honour to David, where Nabal had instead humiliated David. Abigail distances her response from Nabal. She then congratulates David for taking the high ground and points out that God is the one who avenges wrong done. Abigail speaks wisdom by reminding David of whose side he's on and reminds him of God's promise to make a lasting dynasty through him. She acknowledges that although Saul is pursuing him, just as God delivered him a victory over Goliath, so also will he rule over Israel. She reminds David again of the importance of not having on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And David then sees the wisdom of her words. Verse 32, David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord." So he's kind of like done this this real 180 degrees. He's turned right around because of Abigail's wise response. But David says, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands." I just think Abigail's actions are brilliant. She redeems the situation by restoring David's honour, provides a reward for minding the sheep, and then lifts David's eyes to where his true honour and success will come from. Abigail's wisdom echoes Psalm 62:7, which rightly reminds us, in those times when we are wronged, that our honour depends on God. In those times when we are wronged, that our honour depends on God. Psalm 62:7, "My salvation and my honour depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge." Jesus also affirmed this when he taught his disciples that they were to forgive their brother or sister up to 77 times, or to turn the other cheek. In those times of our lives when someone cuts in front of us, maybe in a line, or then we're shortchanged of what we're owed, maybe we've been wrongfully looked over for a promotion, when we're insulted, persecuted, and publicly shamed, that we're not to look and seek an eye for eye. We can still confidently rely on God to right wrongs and to preserve the honour of those who seek to do the right thing under God. Love for others de-escalates. It pursues peace and leaves judgment in God's hands. Where foolishness like Nabal endangers life, wisdom like we see in Abigail seeks to value and protect life. Wisdom protects. It protected Abigail, her people, and furthered God's purpose in David. It was wisdom to listen to her servant's concerns. It was wisdom to quickly respond to bring peace, and wisdom to restore and lift our eyes to God. So Abigail's wise example points us to King Jesus, who also acted to save his people and further God's purposes in response to the foolishness of sin. And we begin to see that in this story, that even though David is saved from sin this time, he's clearly not God's true king. He's a heart for God, heart for righteousness, but his wisdom is not sufficient. It is confirmed at the end of the passage by David taking Abigail as another wife. The narrator confirms his imperfect nature and lack of wisdom, and anticipates further trouble in this area. David has a passionate heart, however, he is occasionally consumed by it. Our story nevertheless serves to point us to what God's people have need of: a king and leader who is both mighty and holy, with a heart for God and wisdom, who serves God's purpose and depends on God to vindicate. In King Jesus, we have this and more. Jesus endured great unjust suffering, where many people wrongfully accused and insulted him, and he repaid kindness. Many people repaid his kindness with insult and injury. And in a night of rage and anger, he was subjected to a humiliating death. But God had a special purpose in this, because Jesus was prepared to suffer and was not prepared to repay evil for evil. God not only vindicated Jesus, but because of Jesus' righteous restraint, God was able to remove our humiliation and provide a way for us to be saved. So God in Jesus gets the glory. As I spent time in this story, I've grown in appreciation of just how close David's anger brought him to his undoing. His uncontrolled anger nearly caused great damage to those around him. And in our lives, while we're not the same as David, as fallen humans, we all have moments and tendencies to let our anger get the best of us. Now, anger is a normal emotion. However, it needs to be restrained and put to the use in protecting of those around us. In Jesus' ministry, he showed us how righteous anger works. And when I think about Jesus, I think about how angry he was when he entered God's temple, and it was being used in such a way as to hinder people from God. Jesus was also angry when some Pharisees were stubborn-hearted, who were more intent on accusing Jesus of doing something wrong on the Sabbath, and they condemned Jesus for healing a man with a shriveled hand. However, when Jesus was angry, it did not lead him to sin. The anger did not control Jesus' response. And Jesus' anger was not out of a self-righteousness, but of out of compassion and protection of others. But so often our anger is expressed in unhealthy ways. Let me read out Ephesians 4, 30 to 32, where it mentions, I believe, this kind of anger. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you are sealed for the day of redemption. Get rid of all bitterness rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. So note the Apostle Paul associates anger with rage, anger that overflows in brawling, the kind of that you're just looking for a fight, or anger that expresses itself in the slander of others and seeks to destroy or tear down others in the use of words. And like David, anger can consume us and lead us to actions in the moment that in the cool of the day we'd never consider doing. So given it's a problem that we're all faced with, let me offer two headings by way of responding to anger that might arise within us. It draws on the wisdom demonstrated by Abigail and can help us to avoid hurting others. So the two headings are patience and perspective. The first is patience. Well, before it went too far, Abigail helped to slow it all down. She met David, talked it over with David, and helped in that case to calm him down. Abigail then waited until the morning to talk to Nabal. Now, don't get me wrong, every situation's different, and I don't think this chapter is a guidebook for us in anger, but I'm noticing here on what has gone right. If you find yourself getting worked up in anger about something, then breathe and slow down. As James says in chapter 1, 19, "My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry." It's far better to deal with matters without the heat of anger. As Dallas Willard says, "There is nothing that can be done with anger that cannot be done better without it." There is nothing that can be done with anger that cannot be done better without it, which is quite provocative. I found for myself, because there are times, definitely times in my life, where I get quite angry at things. But I found giving myself space and time out when I get angry helpful. It can give me enough time to think and then choose to respond in a way that I won't regret. So love is patient. The second way to respond to anger, if we feel it rising within us, is perspective, finding the right perspective. When anger wells up inside, we can feel like we want to pay someone back. We feel hurt and perhaps even rightfully upset, but we want to use our agency or power to settle the score. So without thought, then we act. But what I'm reminded by in Abigail is what our role is and what God's role is. God is the judge and promises to respond to our wrongdoing, to wrongdoing that we face as well. "It is mine to avenge," are God's words in the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. And then it's repeated in this passage in Romans 12. "Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." So as Christians then, we are not to take revenge in words or actions, but are to instead let God's love control us. And because of God's forgiveness to us, we are free to extend this unmerited grace and mercy and forgiveness to others. Of course, which sounds nice, but in the heat of anger, this can be the last thing that we want to do. A disclaimer though, I'm not saying that we shouldn't seek proper reconciliation and justice in our relationships with others, I guess what I'm saying is not to let our anger and hurt control our response and then risk staining our own conscience and hurting others. So they're the two things in the heat of our anger: patience and perspective. Anger's a clue for what's important to us. And if you might be finding that you're wrestling with angry feelings or thoughts, and I think finding help from someone that you trust or a counsellor could also be helpful in keeping you from falling in destructive patterns.